This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What up, y'all? It's your boy Danny Green, three-time NBA champ. You either rooted for me or rooted against me. Join myself and my co-host Harrison Sanford on the Inside the Green Room podcast.
It's a podcast that brings you never-before-told tales from the locker room to candid interviews with basketball legends to breakdowns of what's happening in the NBA right now. Whether you're a diehard fan or casual about your hoops, this podcast brings you the game like never before.
Follow Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, welcome back to Sports Radio 610. Brandon is headed out. Wade Smith is about to join me for the next couple of hours here as we start your July 4th weekend. Brandon is going to be out at Minute Maid Park. As I said, I'll be out there tomorrow as the Astros summer camp begins. And it has been, as we are in the month of July, it's an odd time. Obviously, you would expect that you're going to have baseball in the month of July. We don't have it yet, but we are going to start having it. And, you know, as we get into, you know, month four of quarantine, you start, you know, remembering all the stuff that you're missing, and all the, you know, this whole thing started in March, and it started with the NCAA tournament getting postponed and conference tournaments getting postponed. And for me, that's the stuff that I look forward to every year. I love conference tournaments. I love the NCAA tournament. I went to a college basketball school that has had a great history, so you really learn to love college basketball. Wimbledon would be going on right now. You know, if on a normal day I'd have Wimbledon on it, it'd be the third round. We'd have that on the TV. We don't, because there is no Wimbledon, and you are starting to see some sports come back, especially over in Europe. We were just watching a KBO game in Korea. That's the first baseball league that got started. They're playing baseball in Taiwan. They're playing baseball in Japan. There's not a whole lot, though. And so for me, I know I've missed college basketball. I have missed, like I said, Wimbledon, the NBA playoffs. I really missed, because that's something that is fun. And, you know, right now we'd be right in the middle of NBA free agency. We're missing that. Wade, it's good to see you. Anything in particular that you have missed the most in quarantine?
I tell you what, I just miss any sense of having assurance of what is coming next. As somebody that follows all different types of sports and loves sports in general, the idea that we are, I know, 2.5 weeks away, 3 weeks away from the NBA and the MLB being back, and yet there's still a lot of doubt of it actually taking place. And then there's doubt that if it does start, that you're actually going to finish what you start when it comes to their seasons. There's issues with the NFL right now where they're trying to figure out how they're going to return to play and the proper protocols that you need to make it happen. And you just don't know this. There is no certainty with anything. My entire life, when it comes to sports, I knew when this particular season was going to start. I knew when the big games are going to be. I knew when I can just mark them on my calendar and say, hey, I'm looking forward to seeing that, or I'm looking forward to doing that. I know it has to be hard to imagine, hard to be a current player with there's so much limbo and so much uncertainty of what's going on. It reminds me a little bit about the 2011 season with the lockout. But even in that case, we knew, hey, they were going to lock us out, and we don't know how long it's going to take to get something done. But at the end of the day, once we do get it done, we're all going to play, and we're not worried about anything stopping it. And so right now that's not the case. So I miss the certainty of sports. There is something that, I mean, in life there's a lot of uncertainty. But one thing you knew is that, hey, on Friday nights there's going to be high school football. You knew on Saturdays you're going to have college football. You knew on Sundays you're going to have NFL football. You knew that on Tuesday night, or, you know, you're going to watch basketball on TNT. There's a lot of stuff that you were used to seeing, and now you're not sure if you're going to get that.
I want to get into routines with you as an athlete, because for you in the NFL, you would be about to head to training camp on July 3rd. So how have these guys, how do you think, how would you have managed this type of a situation? And you brought up the lockout, but the lockout was a little bit different because at least in the lockout, you could work out with your teammates. You couldn't do anything with the team, but you could at least work out with your teammates. You could travel. You could go place to place. You can't do that now. So how much does this just mess up the routine of really what these guys mentally go through every year?
I think it's a significant issue. I think that what you're gonna come across is the guys and the people in general, just athletes, people that are in these professional leagues, the ones that have really strong mental toughness and are disciplined and willing to put in the sacrifices that are necessary to be champions, those are going to be the ones that deal with this better than anybody else. If you have issues with mental toughness and being self-disciplined and all those things, this pandemic is just going to exacerbate all of those negative characteristics that you have. And so me personally, I was disciplined, and I don't think I would have had much of an issue of staying to myself. But I know that there's guys around me that would struggle with that. And in the game of NFL sports or NFL football, you need everybody next to you to do their job in order for you to do your job. And so that would cause apprehension, that would cause mistrust, and that's something that every team is going to have to build if they want to be successful for the 2020 season.
2011, the lockout, you were what, 7-8 years in the league at that point?
Yeah, I was a veteran by then. I 2011, I think I was year, it was either 8 or 9.
So
it was year 9.
So how do you think it would have been different for you had it been year 2 or, God forbid, year 1?
Well, I think this is the thing. If you don't know any better, you just expect that's what it's going to be. So like a rookie coming into the league right now, they're not going to realize how it's hurting them, but they're also not going to be out of routine because this is their this is what they know of the NFL. When I first got into the NFL, I played for Dave Wannstedt in Miami. And after the first preseason game we played, they were passing out beer in the locker room. And I was like, what the hell is going on here? Like, there's beer in the locker room? I didn't even think that that was a thing, but that was very normal for everybody there. So I was just like, oh, I'm not in college anymore. This is how we do things. Well, I think about a year or two later, they got rid of that. You couldn't have alcohol in your facilities anymore. You couldn't have them on the plane. So I'm sure there were a bunch of veteran guys that had been used to playing a game and having a couple of brews afterwards that at that point they were like, well, damn, this goes counter to my routine and what I'm used to doing and being able to do after a game. And so they had to adjust to that. Me as a rookie, I experienced it one time. I was kind of like, oh, wow. But then it was not something that I got used to. So I don't think there was no adjustment for me. The rookies coming into the draft or coming out of draft this year, undrafted free agents, their first experience in the NFL is having Zoom meetings and learning on Zoom calls and not being able to be around and get that one-on-one instruction that you normally expect to get. And so because that's the situation that they're in right now, that's just all they know. And it's going to affect them negatively. They're not going to realize it until later down the road. Like, damn, this is kind of weird for me that I'm not used to doing X, Y, and Z, where other guys are going to have to adjust, because NFL players and just professional athletes in general, we are creatures of habit. We need to have a kind of a set routine of how things are going to go. That's going to be one of the toughest things about in all of the professional sports, is they're going to try to get into routines, but certain things are going to happen. People are going to catch it, and it's going to mess up people's routines, and then they're going to have to get ready to play games. And so it's going to be a tough challenge to overcome. I have to give a lot of credit to any professional team that's able to come out of this and win a championship. You got to give them a lot of credit, because it's going to take a lot of mental toughness and discipline and sacrifice to get it done.
Training camps are supposed to start on time. July 28th is the day that training camp is supposed to start. The NFL hasn't announced it, but they're going to push back the start of the preseason. They're going to take off 2 preseason games, which they probably should have always been doing. But is that enough time? Is that, when you consider that you haven't done anything on the field since last season, is that enough time to go from last season to offer 6, 7, 8 months, depending on which team, have a training camp, a somewhat normal training camp, two preseason games, and then head right into the regular season.
It's not ideal, but everybody is playing under the same set of rules, so it's fair. You know what I mean? And so if everybody is starting at the same time and started on the same footing, I guess you could say, then it's fair, and that's all you can ask for. You want to have competitive and fair play throughout your particular league that you're playing in, and talking about the NFL right now. So you're going to be behind the eight ball. Guys are not going to be in sync like you normally would be if you had a normal training camp, if you had a normal OTAs, a normal mini camp, and just off season in general. These things are going to take time to get worked out. And so I think you're going to see that early on in the year. Teams that struggle early on in the year will probably – they're going to be teams that overcome that and look like complete – like night and day when you get to week 9, 10, and then by the time you get towards the end of the season, you're going to see teams progress tremendously over that time because they're going to have opportunities to get work in face-to-face in person at their particular facilities. The thing that you worry about is for those teams that might start slow, the longer the season goes on, the tougher it's going to be to keep your guys in line and keep them disciplined. And if you struggle early on in the year, guys buying in and believing in the system and believing that, hey, if I continue to sacrifice, it's going to pay dividends. You're going to run into some issues there because you're going to start losing some of that buy-in. And then the chances of you catching the virus or people on your team catching the virus and it being spread goes up, because in order to keep these facilities clean, guys are going to have to be really disciplined when they go home and what they decide to do when they're away from the facility. I think if you know you have a championship caliber team and you're winning and you're doing successful things, it's going to be easier for you to be disciplined. And so that's the longer the season goes, you're going to start seeing that play into the things as well.
My big concern with this and with the condensed offseason that you're going to wind up having is the injury aspect of it. And physically, are guys ready to play? You brought up competitively, everyone's going to be dealing with the same conditions, but I'm more worried what happens long term, because it feels like that guys are susceptible to suffering some sort of really serious injury that can have a huge impact on their livelihoods.
Yeah, I mean, but I would say that's part of the deal. When you're playing in the NFL, each play can be your last, and you know that going into it. This is adding in another obstacle and another layer to it, and it's a very difficult layer to deal with, and all the stuff that you're going to have to go to just avoid it doesn't guarantee that you're going to avoid it, and that in itself is going to take some mental fortitude and toughness to overcome, because, I mean, I know what it feels like myself to just go to the gas station, maybe go to the grocery store, come up here to the studio, all the different things that you normally would not do that you do right now just to do very simple, you know, menial tasks like just being a normal citizen in the United States of America. You know what I mean? Well, add on to that, you're going into a facility, you're having to get the test every day. You know what I mean? These protocols, you're going through all these different steps. You're not allowed to. I mean, part of the best part of being in the NFL team is the locker room and the camaraderie and guys being in the lounge, hanging out together in between meetings or going in your meeting rooms. All of those things, it's going to be together, but it's going to be separate at the same time. And it's not going to be the same feel. And so you're going to have to overcome all of that and then go out there and play at a very, very high level. And then overcome injuries. The way you're going to have to rehab from injuries is going to be different than it normally would be. You're going to have to, you know, self-isolate and train at the same time to get yourself back recovered to play. And then the thing about the coronavirus is if you catch it, normally they say it takes 2 weeks for you to be cleared from it, for it to get out your system. But that's not always the case. There's people that they're talking about one of the coaches, I think it was the pitching coach for the Chicago Cubs, he had it in his system for 30 days. And so if you imagine you catch the coronavirus and you miss 30 days worth of time just trying to pass the test, not necessarily, you might not even have any symptoms, but it takes you 30 days to get it out of your system, that's 4 ball games. And that's a quarter of the season. You lose a quarter of the season depending on who you are on the team. That can turn you to being from a playoff team until, you know, 6-10. It could take you from being a serious contender for the Super Bowl to having to play a wild card game. So It's going to be extremely difficult to navigate all the different adversities and obstacles that are going to be in players' paths.
For baseball, that'd be half the season, too.
Yeah.
If you're at 30 days, that's half the season.
60 games is just, it's nothing. It's peanuts. And so you lose 30 days, that's half the season. Depending on what position you play, your team can be done. And that's why I say I got to give a lot of credit to whoever figures it out, whoever has the best processes and the protocols to keep people safe, and then those people that are players that do the right things that are necessary to keep themselves out of trouble, you got to commend them and give them all the credit, because this is an exceptional year.
Bill O'Brien was on the Patriots staff in 2011. They went to the Super Bowl that year. You were on a really good Texans team in 2011. If you could give Bill O'Brien some advice on how to handle this training camp when you really did not have an offseason, what would you tell him to do?
I first and foremost, I'd make sure that all my guys are bought in and bought into what it's going to take to win a Super Bowl this particular year. It's going to be different than any other year. I'm going to make sure that guys understand that what you do off the field is just as important as what you do on the field. And that's usually the case when you're talking about preparation and getting ready to go on the practice field and preparation to get ready for games, getting yourself mentally prepared to do your assignments and know your job and get your job performed at a high level. But now we're adding on to that, you know, the decisions you make, the people that you're around, where you go. And it's not the normal, that is a normal kind of thought process that you communicate to your players, but that's like, hey, don't go to this club or don't go to that place. Don't hang around with those people because they can get you in trouble with the law. It's not talking about that. We're talking about, hey, don't go to this public place where there's a lot of people there because you might catch a virus in the process. You could be doing something that's harmless in a normal situation, but that's actually a high risk situation now these days, and so you're going to have to not do that. And so you got to get guys to buy in and make sure that they do whatever they can to supplement what they're losing by not being there in person.
Basically, the most mature team is going to win this year.
No question about it. The most mature, the most willing to make the right decisions and make the sacrifices that are necessary to keep themselves healthy. Because in the NFL and in any professional sports, health is a deciding factor 9 out of 10 years anyway. 9 out of 10 times, that's going to be the deciding factor. Which team was healthier when it came down the stretch and you went on your run? And a lot of times the team that's not healthy is the one that falls off. You mentioned the 2011 Texans team and 2011 Patriots team. You look at the 2011 Texans, you know, you're missing your starting quarterback. Your starting receiver missed a bunch of time. Your running back missed a bunch of time. Your starting outside linebacker missed a bunch of time. You had a lot of guys at key roles that missed a bunch of time, and eventually it caught up with that 2011 team. You know, a healthier version of that team goes a lot farther. And so now you're adding another element. All of those injuries that were sustained were just normal. Hey, we're playing football and it's a dangerous sport and you're going to lose players. Now you're adding another element to it, and it's going to be a tough road to hoe.
He's Wade Smith. I'm Adam Spillane. We are here until 10. When we come back, is it possible that we've had Bill Belichick pegged wrong all along, and he's in fact a perfect match for Cam Newton? We're going to hear Belichick basically begging his players to be like Newton when we come back on Sports Radio 610.
Kicking off your 4th of July weekend, here's Adam Spillane and Wade Smith.
Back on Sports Radio 610, we are here until 10 o'clock. Hope you're having a good start to your July 4th weekend. Big story in the NFL, one of the big stories in the NFL this past week has been Cam Newton signing with the New England Patriots. And what's been interesting about that is Cam Newton doesn't seem like the type of guy who would fit in New England. The Patriots are known to be very straight-faced, we just go about our business. And a lot of that is brought on by Bill Belichick, who basically is boring. I mean, flat out, Bill Belichick always has the appearance of being boring. You see him, his tone of voice never changes. He never gets excited on the sideline. And now you bring in Cam Newton, and it feels like, how are these two guys going to mesh? But to me, it kind of seems like Cam Newton is the perfect guy for Bill Belichick. And I'm going to explain why, because, and this was Stephen Ruiz brought up this video on Twitter. And it's Belichick in the video room in meeting with his players, and he's basically begging them to celebrate, basically begging them to be demonstrative. And this is him talking to his players about that.
There's nothing wrong. In fact, you should be excited when you make a play. Hell, look at all the work you've put into it, all the time that you've spent and practice of put into it. And to go out there in a game competitively and execute it well and make a play, you should be excited about it. And your teammates should be excited too. And you see when we're playing with energy and when we're playing with emotion and when we're not.
This to me was a fascinating 20, 30 seconds, whatever it was. Because I've never heard a coach say that before.
See, this is my thing. I think this is a product of media members trying to extrapolate the way that Bill Belichick interacts with them to put that on how he feels about how his players should interact when they're on the actual field. Like, you gotta understand, Bill Belichick's favorite player of all time is Lawrence Taylor. Can you think of any player that is more demonstrative when he's on the field, the way that he plays, the reckless abandon, the ability to celebrate and have a good time when he's playing the game of football, destroying people, and then the way he was off of the field where he was showing up to games, showing up to practice late, but just going out there and balling. This is one of Bill Belichick's favorite players of all time. He don't care about that. Do you do your job? Do you produce? Do you bring emotion with you when you come to the table? I think the thing about it is with Cam Newton, is Bill Belichick is going to expect Cam Newton to not give the media anything. That's why, that's when you listen to Tom Brady's interviews that he does on Monday Night Football, on the radio show that he does, he's not going to give the media anything to really chew on and go places. Even though he's going to do these interviews and he's going to make his money off of and he's going to expand his brand, he's not going to do anything that could be detrimental to the Patriots organization. That's the way that Cam Newton is going to be kind of, I guess you would say, muzzled, because, hey, you're not going to be able to communicate as freely as you normally would here as you did when you were in Carolina. But besides that, I fully expect Cam Newton to be Cam Newton. He doesn't really do the Superman thing anymore, but whatever celebration he decides to do, he comes up to do with in New England, he's going to do it. He's still going to walk to the game and show up to the games dressed in his peacock suits and all the stuff he has going on. That is Cam Newton. That's what helps him get prepared to play ball games and gets him feeling right. Bill Belichick's going to be all for that.
You say the word muzzle. So basically, when you're there in New England from post-game Sunday to Saturday, you are muzzled. But once you're on the field, you can express yourself whatever way you want, is what Bill Belichick is saying.
Yes, and you know what? Players, and I was one of them because I never played for Belichick, but half of my career I played for organizations that were under the Belichick Parcells tree. And it's the same thing. It's the same thing right now here in Houston. The powers that be will give you talking points to say to the media so that you don't have to give them anything real. And I enjoyed and appreciated that type of scenario because I knew my teammates weren't going to say anything crazy that was going to jeopardize our chemistry and what we had going on in the locker room. And I knew that I could go back and say something that I wanted to say. Or if there was something that was asked me and it was something controversial, I knew I could address it with this particular talking point. Now, here when I was with the Texans, I was not under that tree. Fortunately for me, I was a veteran guy, so I knew how to field all those questions and dodge those landmines that are kind of out there that the media might throw to you. And so it wasn't a big deal, and I enjoyed the liberty and the freedom that Gary Kubiak and that coaching tree, Bill Walsh's coaching tree, gives to their players. The Belichick tree, the Parcells tree, it's the exact opposite, but that is a silver lining that you don't have to deal with the media, and they don't have as much accessibility. They're going to try to get the players in there and be in that area for the bare minimum of time and then go back to just being an athlete and being a football player and not having to worry about any extracurricular stuff. So I think that he's going to enjoy that part of it because Cam Newton and the media haven't had the best relationship over the years.
What I thought was interesting, too, is that you have Belichick saying that essentially if you aren't celebrating after a big play, it means you're not engaged and you're not ready to play.
Nice play, Ty. Can't even see one guy saying, good hit. Walk back to the huddle, and it's a gut. It looks like we don't even care.
Yeah. I mean, that is exactly right. You got to play this game with emotion. You got to understand that everybody that you're playing with or against is the best of the best at what they do in the world. And so you have to figure out ways to gain an edge. And if you're playing the game with a lack of emotion, that will translate to having a lack of performance on the field. You got to bring that emotion. You got to enjoy the game. You have to have passion for the game. And you cannot hold that stuff in and bottle it up. You got to outwardly express it. Now, there's certain things that you can do that's off the wall. You know, if it's third and 28 and you catch a 20-yard pass and you have to punt and you jump up and you're doing a backflip and talking noise to the DB, we're going to look at you like you're crazy. I remember the time when DeAndre Hopkins, the Texans, were getting blown out by somebody. I can't remember who it was. But late in the ball game, D-Hop caught a touchdown pass and people tried to come to celebrate him. He was like, nah, move around. We're losing this game. At that point, the emotion is not necessary and it's not required and it's not something you would expect. But when you're playing in a ball game and you're trying to win and it's a competitive situation, let that emotion out. Let everybody know. Let your teammates know that you are happy with what they did and that they made something happen so they can, bring that energy. And that's something that is absolutely necessary.
The last part of this Belichick clip is that this is an old clip. This is over 10 years old. And it's the next season. And he's talking about a Monday night game against the Broncos where they won 41-7. And he's bringing up the way that they were celebrating, where it essentially sent a message to the Broncos that day.
Just look at this right here. Do you think we were ready to play against Denver last year, Monday night? It's so obvious. It's so visible. And when you can show that picture visually to your opponent, that's what intimidation is. That's the look right there, fellas. It's going to be a long night.
And when he says it's going to be a long night, because they're showing the video, and I think it's Champ Bailey just having this long look on his face like, man, they are destroying us right now.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool for him to just point that out. Have you ever had a coach really like stress that in a meeting before?
No, because you got to understand this. Most of the time, I've never been on a team where guys didn't play with emotion. I could understand if you're playing for the New England Patriots and you're around Bill Belichick and you're around a guy that talks like this the whole time, and it's very much monotone, you might bring some of those qualities and traits with you on the field. And so I think he's having this meeting with the guys he was having at the time to let them know, even though I'm this way, I want you to be you out there on the field. I want you to bring the emotion you have to. And a lot of times when you're in the middle of training camp or you're in some of the dog days of training camp and the Tua days and it's Groundhog Day and you're like, damn, we're doing the same thing over and over again. You don't bring as much energy and passion as you otherwise would because you're beat up, you're hurt, you're tired. And it's that type of meeting is a reminder. Like, listen, when you play like this and you bring this type of energy, this is the type of success that you're going to have. And this is what it signals to your opponent. So I've never been in a meeting where that was particularly, a video was shown in that manner. But the sentiment that he's bringing across, definitely you've experienced as a player, because it's difficult to bring energy every single day. It's tough to be on 10 every single day. And sometimes you need to be reminded of that.
I'm sure you've talked about this plenty throughout the week, but sorry for making you repeat it. The Newton contract, I think Richard Sherman called it he said disgrace or despicable, something like that. I don't see it that way. I see it as he held out for a chance to start, and he's going to get to start for a really good team in all likelihood and really build up his value. How did you see it?
I look at it like this, man. Cam Newton signed a deal, so he was good with it. And if Cam Newton is good with it, that is what it is. You know what I mean? If you don't think a deal is a good deal, you don't have to sign it. This is the free country. They're not forcing you to sign a contract. There are some contracts out there, and there's always contracts out there as players that you look at and like, how the hell did he get paid that much money? But I'm not one to pocket watch. If he was able to negotiate this deal and get it done, then salute him. Salute his agent, salute his situation and the timing of his career. Cam Newton's timing of his career is not the best. You got a situation where there's not many jobs available, so there's no teams playing off one another. He's also looking at an organization that wins championships, seems like every other year, or they're right there in the mix every year. And so they can use that to leverage not paying salaries out the way that you might have to do it if you're at a different franchise. If you're the Cleveland Browns, you might have to pay a premium to get a primetime player as opposed to the Patriots. They have veteran guys come to their roster every year that are willing to take pay cuts because they want to win. And so I understand his line of thinking when he's saying a guy like Cam Newton, a guy like Jameis Winston, guys that actually have pelts on the wall that have played and had successful careers, shouldn't be getting paid minimum salaries when guys like, oh, what's my guy in New Orleans that got the 2-year, $21 million deal? I can't think of his name right
now. Taysom Hill?
Taysom Hill. Taysom Hill gets that kind of extension, and he really hasn't done anything. From that perspective, you say, well, damn, how was he able to negotiate that deal, and these guys are getting peanuts? I get that sentiment, but in Cam Newton's case, he chose to go there for a specific reason. Jameis Winston chose to go to New Orleans for a specific reason. They were following the same Jameis is following the same path that Teddy Bridgewater did. And Teddy Bridgewater went to New Orleans. He stayed there, I think it was 2 years. He could have left the year before, but he stayed there 2 years because he wanted to learn and get better as a quarterback. He got his opportunities while he was there, and now he's going to be a starting quarterback for the Carolina Panthers. And so those guys specifically knew we're going to take a step back in order to take a step forward, and they went into situations where these are big-time programs in the NFL, and so that was just part of it.
It's almost too simplistic to look at. And the one thing that I saw people say, well, Chase Daniel is making $4 million. He signed, you know, a $13 million deal with the Bears or with the Lions. Well, he did that knowing that he was going to be the backup.
Yeah.
Like, he went into that knowing that he was signing to be in a certain situation. You think Cam Newton would have signed that deal with the Lions? It's very highly unlikely that he would have gone somewhere and say, you know, I'll go be the backup to Matthew Stafford for a couple of years.
You said Jameis Winston, or are you talking about Cam Newton?
Chase Daniel.
Because I heard Chase Daniel, but I'm saying you said that one of the quarterbacks would not go to
Cam.
Detroit. Oh, Cam, yeah. Yeah, exactly right. Cam Newton wouldn't do that because he knows that he's trying to go somewhere he's going to have opportunity to play and hit a home run and get paid another large contract. You're not going to get that if you go to Detroit. But Chase Daniels has figured out a way to beat the system his entire career, and I ain't mad at him. I mean, he's probably thrown less than 100 passes.
I think he started 5 games.
Yeah, he started 5 games in his career. He's probably thrown about 100 passes. But when he plays, his passer rate, I mean, his rating, I think, is like in the 90s for his career. So that means every time he goes out there, he's having decent to good ball games. So people have somebody that they are comfortable with. Those guys took step back so that they can take a huge step forward. Chase Daniels is never going to get the contract that Jameis and Cam potentially would get next season.
He went to the right teams. He went to the Saints, and he went to play for Sean Payton. He went to play for Andy Reid. Kind of worked out for him.
Yeah, no question. I ain't met him.
He did it right.
Represents the state of Texas the right way, baby.
When we come back, we all know J.J. Watt's probably going to the Hall of Fame. Wade, you played with him when he was a rookie. I want to know from you, when did you know he was going to be great? That's coming up next on Sports Radio 610.
Kicking off your 4th of July weekend, here's Adam Spillane and Wade Smith. Like I'm Biggie Papa,
baby. Back on Sports Radio 610, taking you up until 10 o'clock. And Wade, I want to take you back to training camp 2011. So almost 9 years. And you're with the Texans. You're back from the lockout. And there's this rookie defensive lineman, J.J. Watt. You knew who he was because he's a first-round pick. And I don't know how it is with you guys, but I imagine that everyone is aware of the first-round pick once you get into training camp. He's marked.
Yeah, I tell you what, I remember him getting drafted. I don't know if I was a draft party or not, but I remember seeing it. Maybe I saw it on TV or I was actually there. I can't remember that year. Might have been signing autographs or whatever, but I remember him being booed. And I remember thinking to myself, who the hell is J.J. Watt? I had no clue about who this guy was, watching his little highlight tape. And yeah, I understand that by then I think I was like my ninth year in the league. And so paying attention to what the rookies did before they got to the team, unless you were a guy like Deshaun Watson or somebody that was a quarterback in college football that did tremendous things, you really didn't pay too much attention. It was kind of in passing. But when I saw his highlights, I was like, okay, he's got a little get up and go. But you kind of knew that J.J. was going to be a hell of a football player when we first started doing OTAs, and he was batting down passes. Like, every time you looked up, he's batting down passes. And he played on the other side, so So he was going against Eric Winston and Mike Brazel all the time. And now they would tell me like, "Hey, this rookie's gonna be good, man. You got to watch out. Like he's got a little something." And so he went through that entire season, and he was a good player, but he was just missing making big plays. And you could tell that he was a step away, a step and a half away from making a bunch of plays. But you could see he was beating offensive linemen. He was making plays and enforcing it to where other guys were able to make plays in the backfield. And so you really saw him kind of blossom in that playoff game against the Cincinnati Bengals when he got the pick six. And after that, it was all history. And at that point, I think to myself, all right, this guy is going to be a Hall of Famer. But you knew you had something in J.J. Watt.
Yeah, you bring up the Wisconsin stuff. He was overshadowed at Wisconsin because he's on the same team as Russell Wilson. And so their teammates at Wisconsin, and it was a good Wisconsin team, but it was Russell Wilson.
I think
Wilson.
They went to the Rose Bowl.
Yeah, they won the Big Ten that year. And Wilson had transferred, you know, because he had been at NC State. He transferred to Wisconsin because NC State wouldn't let him play baseball.
Yeah.
Because he got drafted by the Rockies, and the Rockies, he played a couple of seasons in the Rockies organization, which is a whole other story about why he decided to leave. But so he's overshadowed. He's a guy who transfers from Central Michigan, so he really comes out of nowhere to wind up being, you know, a first half of the first round type guy. But you mentioned that Bengals game was really the first time. I think everyone knew that he had a pretty productive rookie season.
Yeah.
But it was that interception where he started to really become noticed. And I asked Romeo Crennel this question about Tom Brady when the Texans played the Patriots in the playoffs a couple of three, 4 years ago. I asked him, when did he know that Tom Brady was going to be a great player? And he said it was, remember that drive against the Rams in the Super Bowl?
Yeah.
And it was the second play of that drive when he completes a short pass. It might have been to Jermaine Wiggins. He completes a short pass because he just barely got the pass off in time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he knew that, okay, this guy sees everything on the field. He's going to be a star. And Brady had started, the last 14 games of the regular season for them.
Yeah.
Two playoff games already, and then the Super Bowl, and it took for the last drive of the Super Bowl for him to realize that Tom Brady was going to be a star in this league.
Well, I tell you what, I think Romeo was a little bit late on the draw there because I played for the Miami Dolphins that season, and we played the New England Patriots. It was week six. At that time, we were 4-1, Dolphins. Or we were 4-2. We were either 4. I think we were 4-2, so it might have been week seven. I think we were 4-2 at the time. And we lost to them in overtime, and we lost on a deep bomb that he threw and beat us in overtime. I think the score was 19-13. But the fact that they were able to come back and win that game against us, I was like, who in the hell is this Tom Brady? And like what's going on here? Like what's up with this dude? But you could just tell he had that it factor. And so as games went on and they continued to win, you thought to yourself like, all right, this dude has it. And he's Tom Brady. And you saw what he did in the Super Bowl against the Rams where you knew, hey, this dude and this team really is not supposed to be on the same level as the Rams. The Rams, back then, were the greatest show on turf. Their offense was ridiculously good. They had a good defense, solid defense as well. But they were able to pull that game out and get the W. And so, wait a minute, you're talking about the Rams game in what year?
01.
01. Okay, so then I'm late on the draw. All right, you just let me go through that whole conversation. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm thinking about the 2003 season.
Yeah, so this was 01. So this was the year that Bledsoe got hurt.
Yeah.
So it took him he started 14 games after Bledsoe got hurt in the regular season.
Yeah.
And then the two playoff games before the Super Bowl, and then it was the Super Bowl where he realized that, okay, this guy is going to, and it wasn't even, you know, it's a short pass. It's a short completion. It's always fascinating to me, the little details that make you understand how great a guy can be. So I want to go back to Watt. So you said that Bengals playoff game was when you really started to take notice. Okay, this guy is something.
Yeah.
When did you see, when did it go up a level for you with him?
Well, I would say it like this when it comes to JJ. I think he realized that he was something at that point. And I think the world saw that he was something at that point. The next season, over the next couple of seasons, you saw JJ become a dominant force day in and day out at practice, and then you saw how dominant of a force he became each and every Sunday. I remember him messing up his elbow, and I can't remember, I don't know if it was 2012 or 2013, but I think it might have been 2012 when he messed up his elbow in training camp. And everybody was like, oh, like JJ can't get hurt. You know what I mean? Because you knew what he brought to the table. By that point in his career, he was a guy that you knew was on track to be a Hall of Fame quality player, because we had a damn good team and he regularly beat our good players. You know what I mean? If you're regularly beating players on a damn good team and you're head and shoulders above a lot of people around you that are damn good football players, you know, all right, this guy is special. And so there wasn't a particular moment where you saw it on the field where you said, all right, this guy's special. You saw it day in and day out, each and every practice, that he was consistently winning. He was doing things that were unorthodox. He was doing things that weren't sound, defensively sound technique, but he was still making plays. If you can go behind a block and still make the play in the backfield before, you know, an offensive lineman can react to you, that is something that only special people can do. And so you knew that JJ was a special player.
I always find it interesting just how long it takes for people to realize it. Sometimes it's quick. You know, sometimes you realize it pretty immediately, but I don't think you ever put that Hall of Fame grade on someone that quickly. So I want to go to Deshaun Watson. I think that when he got drafted, Dabo Swinney called him Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
Because you saw what he did in college, but a lot of guys have done that in college. A lot of guys have been really good in college and it doesn't translate. At what point with Watson did you know, okay, this is going to translate in the NFL?
Well, I think that the difference between Deshaun Watson and some of the guys you might have been describing where they did it in college but they couldn't in the league is Deshaun Watson did it against some of the best defenses of all time in college football in the national championship games, at the biggest stage against the best opponent that was like an NFL team, because Nick Saban runs his team like an NFL team when it comes to how much attention to detail there is on the defensive side of the ball, on the offensive side of the ball as well. But they play an NFL style of defense. And so because of that, you're going to say to yourself, all right, if he can do that against them, it's going to project when he goes into the league, when it's a normal 12 o'clock game against the Tennessee Titans. That moment is nowhere near as big as what it has been the last two national championship games, to where he's putting up 400 yards a game and making game-winning touchdown drives. Like, you knew that Deshaun Watson was a special guy. So when Dabo says he's Michael Jordan, you believed it. And then once he got into the league and you see a lot of the plays that he's making off script, off schedule, that you're like, players are not able, normal guys are not able to do a lot of the things that Deshaun can do. He does things that are absolutely out of the realm of any normal, you know, practical means. Sometimes he looks like an alien out there. Like how was he able to get out of the situation with the Buffalo Bills? How was he able to get out of the situation with the Oakland Raiders? How was he able to make some of the plays in his first season where he was making plays against the Seattle Seahawks? Like these types of plays off script, off schedule, exceptional plays, you knew this dude is special. And you were just hoping that they could put everything together as far as putting pieces around him and putting the right scheme together so that he can fully reach and realize his potential. And so that's what you're seeing right now with the Houston Texans.
I want to go to one other guy because Watson, everyone knew from college. Everyone knew what he was able to do against Nick Saban in Alabama, those two national championship games. Talk about Watt. But what about DeAndre Hopkins? Was a guy who was drafted late in the first round.
Yeah.
And the college career, it wasn't quite as smooth as Watson's was. Clemson wasn't on that big stage at that point. They had not been able to break through. And and Hopkins, you know, you guys were on the 2-14 Texans team, so you didn't get a ton of production. The quarterback play wasn't very good that year. So with Hopkins, did you know just watching him that rookie year that he was going to be special, or did it take a little extra time for him?
See, when you look at guys that are Hall of Fame players, the guys that are exceptional, they have some quality about them that is different than pretty much everybody else around them. And his hands, his ability to go up to make one-handed grabs, his ability to just high point balls and make plays, His ability to be in tight man coverage, but somehow come up with that 50-50 ball. He was exceptional at that his rookie year, as soon as he came into the league. And mind you, we had Andre Johnson as our starting, you know, our number one receiver. But you saw that DeAndre had that ability to go up and get any ball, and he played the game in a very physical manner. And so did I know then this was going to extrapolate out and he was going to have multiple year after year production to where he was going to be, you know, a 1,000-yard receiver and widely considered the number one receiver in the league? No. But he had that trait that not a lot of people have. And and players that have a trait that is extraordinary, they have a greater propensity to winning and being a Hall of Fame type of player. And so Chris Carter has those hands that you said, okay, dude wasn't even that fast, but he had exceptional hands. He's a Hall of Famer because he's able to utilize those hands to make his game what it needed to be. DeAndre Hopkins is one of those dudes that had those hands like Chris Carter, and he also has that dog in him, that no fear mentality. You saw that throughout his rookie year. So when you have that at a young age, you know that this dude is going to do great things. You have to see him continue to progress and see it over a certain period of time before you say, all right, this dude is a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, it's a little easier to project this stuff out in the NFL just because guys are older. You know, they're 21, 22 years old when they get drafted. I always find it interesting, and it's what makes recruiting tough because you're trying to project essentially kids. The baseball draft, you're trying to project, you know, 16-year, you know, when you're signing guys internationally, you're projecting 16-year-olds. You're drafting guys out of high school, you're projecting 18-year-olds. I had Nolan Arenado with the Rockies when he was 18 years old, and you saw he was a second-round pick. All right, this guy's going to be good. And then I remember he just burst on to the scene, and he's winning Gold Glove after Gold Glove, and he's having monster season after monster season. I remember talking to our manager, the guy who managed that team that we had in 2009 with Arenado, like, all right, we knew he was going to be good, but did you see this? He said, oh, I didn't see this coming. I thought he was going to be a big leaguer. I didn't think he was going to be an elite, every year all-star, possible Hall of Famer. So I want to take you back to somebody you played with at Memphis.
Okay.
And your last year at Memphis, you played with D'Angelo Williams.
Yeah.
Who was a freshman.
Yeah.
He was productive as a freshman, but did you see, okay, this guy is A, going to be in the NFL one day, and B, he's going to also be a Pro Bowler.
For sure, because D'Angelo, mind you, his freshman year, I think he had 900 and some yards rushing, but we also had another 1,000-yard rusher. So, I mean, he was, I know you mentioned he was productive, but he was productive on a team that had a senior running back that eventually went to the NFL that had over 1,000 yards, and then D'Angelo was just under 1,000 yards. So you knew that D'Angelo was special. You saw, like, when we saw his highlight tapes coming out of high school and he was having a bunch of 60 yards, 70 yards, 80-yard touchdown runs, playing high school football in Arkansas. And then when he got to Memphis, you knew, like, this dude is special. You know what I mean? He just, some people have that it factor. D'Angelo, you saw it very early. He was one of the more highly touted recruits that came into the program in a really long time. And so you knew that, all right, this dude was special, and the fact that he chose Memphis was a good get for the program. And so then once we put him in there, you saw him taking long runs in practice. You saw him perform well against whoever we played against. And so he did a good job. And so you knew that he was a guy that was going to extrapolate out to have a hell of a college career. Did you think that he was going to be, you know, lead the NCAA in rushing for his career by the time he was done? No, but there's nobody that you can say that about, because football is a team sport, and you need people around you to be good at their jobs in order for you to be exceptional at yours. And so that's what was kind of the deciding factor. It wasn't what D'Angelo was going to do or not do. Were the people around them going to be good enough so that he can go out there and prosper? And that's what happened. And the guys around him were good enough. You know, offensive line was good enough. The offensive play calling was good enough. The receivers were good enough. Quarterback play, Danny Wimprine, was good enough to where D'Angelo wasn't going to have 8-man boxes every time he lined up and played. And so he ended up having a hell of a career in college, and then that did the same thing in the NFL.
He's Wade Smith. I'm Adam Spillane. We've got 1 hour to go. When we come back, the Antonio Brown to the Texans rumors are kind of there. We do need to address it. We'll do that next on Sports Radio 610.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.